Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Redbox Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. Hope you're very well on a Tuesday. Carol Walker in the hot seat yesterday, so thank you, Carol, for letting me go to the circus. That's what I did on my day off. Anyway, back to the far more serious business of politics. Coming up on today's episode, Nicola Sturgeon and Alex Salmond, once the golden couple of Scottish independence. They've had quite the tiff falling out. What impact will all that have on the prospect of Scottish independence? We'll speak to the two authors of a new book which lifts the lid on their extraordinary feud. That's coming up in the big thing in just a moment. But first, it's today's columnist panel. No David Ivanovich today. He's off having another spray tan, I think, because the weather's been so bad this summer. But we've still got the Times' Daniel Finkelstein and journalist Emma Wolfe. Let's start with this phrase. In fact, it's the very first words on the top story on the Times today. The special relationship was under strain last night. So after those Pentagon leaks claimed that the US had kept open the gate at Kabul airport, despite knowing there was a high risk of attack in order to assist the British evacuation. Rather than sort of focus on the specifics, I just wonder about this phrase, the special relationship, Danny. Should we stop using it? If anything we've learned over the past few weeks is that the UK has little or no influence on America, and America doesn't seem particularly inclined to take much notice of us.
Well, there are aspects of our relationship that are special, in particular our defence capability and theirs. But I think it's more serious than just our special relationship with the United States. This is a problem with their entire commitment to the idea of an Atlantic alliance with an international role, and to the whole idea of a kind of Western foreign policy committed to freedom and liberty. And whether that is possible, whether or not we've learned that we can't do what we thought we could do, whether or not patience has gone out, whatever the reason, and everyone will have different arguments about whether it was right or wrong thing. I do think the relationship is fundamentally changing. And yeah, this is a historic event, Afghanistan, never mind the gate so much and these briefings. The whole incident is definitely an indication of the change in America's priority and outlook, and the impact that it has on us is profound.
What do you make of this? Is this sort of reality catching up with the policy decisions made by successive US presidents now, Barack Obama, Donald Trump and now Joe Biden, have been heading this direction already, but we just chose to ignore it by instead talking about Winston Churchill busts and who was holding whose hand?
Yeah, well, this blame game is kicking off because the US and the UK were embarrassed at the, you know, shameful and bungled withdrawal from Afghanistan. I think because of our sort of historic closeness with the US, we've just become complacent about the special relationship. It's a really easy phrase. It's very lazy. And I think that we haven't really worked at keeping this relationship. You know, like all relationships, you've got to work at it. I don't think there's been much work gone into keeping it close or special. You don't feel that Johnson and Biden are on each other's sort of speed dial. They don't appear to be close. And as you pointed out, Matt, Boris Johnson completely failed to influence Biden at all at the emergency discussions last week at the G7. Can we extend? No, absolutely not, he said, and just absolutely didn't take any notice of Boris Johnson. So I think, you know, there's not much special going on in this relationship at the moment.
Danny, where should our, if not America, where should our sort of alliances lie, do you think?
Look, I still think there's a huge amount of power and importance lying in rebuilding a relationship with the United States, although much of that is to do with their own politics and what they want to do and to achieve. I don't think much can be achieved unless we try to rebuild political relationships, I would say, particularly on the centre-right, about international relationships and some sort of international vision, and we haven't got that at the moment. You know, there have been moments in the special relationship where the relationship has been strong, but we've taken a different view, you know, Wilson over Vietnam, or even Reagan and Thatcher over Grenada and over Libya. Those were very different positions, and actually over nuclear weapons negotiation. The United States domestic policy and their foreign policy will not be the same as ours. That doesn't mean the relationship isn't strong or important to both of us. I think it is. But what worries me is a waning in both of our countries, but particularly in the United States, in our vision of what we can achieve at all. To be quite honest, our relationship doesn't matter so much if the United States has decided that it doesn't really see itself as having a domestic role, an international role, beyond its immediate security concerns.
And what about you, Emma? Who do you think we should be? You know, there's been various talk. You know, Boris Johnson actually did try to ally with France and Germany last week over trying to get America to extend the deadline to leave Afghanistan. Should we try and repair some of those relations with Europe?
Yeah, well, obviously that's really difficult as well with Brexit and with the sort of quite a lot going on in Germany too at the moment, and in France, of course. But I do think that we should be trying to rebuild much stronger relations with Europe. Absolutely. But also I think that we need to put some work in with Biden. I don't think the work has gone into it at all. And I think everyone's surprised as well, you know, after the sort of shock of Donald Trump. I think lots of people just assumed that Biden was going to be more of an internationalist, and his foreign policy credentials were actually a key plank of his appeal to be re-elected. And it's been a shock, this, hasn't he? Hasn't it? Quite, sort of quite how sort of cold-eyed and defiant he's been about not being involved and not helping anyone else.
Yeah, it turns out the guy who was repeatedly argued to bring home troops from Afghanistan was then quite keen to bring home troops to Afghanistan when he turned out to be president. Let's move away from Afghanistan and let's focus on a domestic story. It's slightly lighter as well, it has to be said. On the front of the Daily Mail, if you can tear your eyes away from the enormous picture of Marietta Foster. Exclusive. Government may introduce levy on disposable nappies to tackle landfill crisis. Parents face new nappy tax. Now, we should point out that Downing Street is desperately trying to hose down this idea, and so they're not going to introduce this. But Emma, we've spoken before about your son on the show.
I'm reeling at you just saying hose down. I've just changed a really spectacular nappy mat, and I'm not sure I want the image. I really have, and I'm not sure I want the image of hosing down.
Good morning, if anyone's eating their breakfast. What are you doing eating your breakfast this late in the day? But Emma, what do you make of this? And I suppose to some extent, this is what happens when big ideas about meeting abstract climate targets come up against the reality of, well, how do you actually do that then? How do you stop loads of rubbish going to landfill?
No, it's really, really important. And I thought the 2015, the levy on single-use plastics was, I mean, it's been a huge success and it was brilliant. And, you know, that's a different thing. Of course, we need to reduce the wastage of single-use plastics. And, you know, that was about people who just couldn't be bothered to take a cloth bag or to take their rucksack using multiple plastic bags. But I think the nappy tax is different. Nappy changing, as we all know, is very time consuming, fairly unpleasant, and, you know, is a big part of being, my baby's 13 months, and it's a big part of your life, especially as a single mother. I'm not sure this is fair. I think that actually, let's just make nappies more green. It can't be impossible. There's a huge amount of plastic that goes into nappies. And if it were possible, yes, one would all use reusable, you know, reusables. But actually, there's a lot of work involved in reusing cloth nappies, washing them. And actually, that's not great for the environment either, because you have to wash them in a washing machine at 90 degrees or something. I don't think this is fair. I really don't. And I think we need to focus on making nappies recyclable.
And I suppose, actually, we've seen them, you know, coffee cups and that sort of things have things that have to contain large amounts of fluid have been made out of things that, they have transferred into things that are more biodegradable and all that sort of thing. So it just seems as if it's something that's possible. Danny, I think your nappy changing days are slightly longer ago.
Yeah, they are, but you don't forget that in a hurry. I agree with the. Actually, you know what? It was a funny thing, which everyone always goes on about, like changing the nappies. But I find it when it's your own kids, I didn't really mind it very much. But because they're your own kids, aren't they? But the truth is that I have two problems with this. One is I think that you have to put the taxation emphasis on the businesses that are creating these products to give them incentives to create new products that work. And plastic, for all that we're worried now about its environmental impact, has had an amazing impact on the survival of people in the third world, on the cleanliness of water, all sorts of things that we don't necessarily have to grapple with in big Western cities, but it's made a huge difference. So the first thing is, I'm not sure that putting the tax on the end user is the right place to put the tax. The second is that ultimately we are not going to solve the climate crisis, in my view, one nappy at a time. We are going to solve the climate crisis in the end by big technological developments that enable us to somehow counter the effect of the development that we're making. The idea that we are going to persuade all the developing countries in the world, or all the first-time parents in the world, to live less good lives after we've led them, we just won't be able to do this politically. What will happen is that as the growth goes down, attention will go back, as it always does, away from green issues, which we recognise are crucial at moments of affluence, and we won't be able to make the progress we think we're going to make. The emphasis has got to be on a scientific solutions, technological solutions, and giving the investment and backing to the people developing these on a global scale. That is how we're going to get out of this. I don't think sitting outside Pret a Manger with a sign saying save the climate or taxing individual nappies, each of these can make a contribution to something at least, but they won't solve the problem.
Somebody's messaged in, nappy changing does not take a long time. What a lot of nonsense. Reusable nappies are environmentally the best idea. Come on, young mums, help the planet and save your children's future.
Not saying nappy changing takes a long time. I can do it in 10 seconds,
You get very adept at doing it at unusual places as well,
You spend a lot of time changing nappies. What I said was washing, reusing cloth nappies takes a heck of a lot of time. And look, if we can put rockets into space, we can actually invent recyclable nappies. As you say, goodness knows the contents of nappies are biodegradable. There's absolutely no reason why they can't be recyclable.
Yeah, and actually one of those things that we'll probably find is that if you can come up with a solution, that solution could be used in loads of other places as well.
Of course.
And then hopefully the price of it will come down too. It's on a sort of similar topic, this, all to do with going green. Obviously in Scotland we've got for the first time the Green Party entering government alongside the SNP following their cooperation agreements, not a coalition. But Greta Thunberg has already weighed in and said Scotland is not a world leader on climate change, telling the BBC that she recognised some countries do a bit more than others, but none were coming close to what was needed. And she said some politicians were less worse than others, which we won't dwell on the grammar, but let's focus on the point that is this a big moment, Danny, the Green Party entering power in the UK for the first time?
Yes. So first of all, I think it's the right thing for Green Party to do much better than so-called rebellion. They have to then grapple with the real problem, try to make Scotland or elsewhere greener in practical terms that actually make some sort of difference. Secondly, I just you know, Greta Thunberg, I've got great respect for anybody who grapples with the size of big problems and is engaged with things that really matter. So I have respect for her. I just don't agree. I don't think that she's right about how the best, you know, how the we're going to tackle this problem. I think she thinks that we're going to tackle this problem in some as yet unspecified way, involving her in traveling across the sea in a boat. We are not going to solve the problem like that, because people aren't going to do that. The political consent for it will break down. And in any case, the climate impact will be felt in other ways. We're going to do it through science and technology. So in that way, she is correct that Scotland isn't the leading country. And also, by the way, it won't be the leading country, because even if it was an independent country, it'd be massively too small to be a leading country on pretty much anything. And certainly on climate, because the places where the problem comes are big places like China and India, and you know, small countries, China or even Scotland or even England, aren't going to solve the problem by ourselves.
Oh, you're going to upset the Scots. Well, we'll be talking more about Scotland just after 11 o'clock as well. Emma, your final thought on Greta and Scotland.
Oh, dear. Oh, look, her aims are laudable, absolutely, but I find her wildly irritating. She's, what, 17, 18 years old. Of course she has all these, you know, spectacularly wonderful ideas, but actually to say she's not 100% sure whether she'll dignify the COP26 with her presence, you know, this kind of thing, and passing judgment on politicians who've actually been working on the green agenda for decades. It was the final line in this interview with Greta that killed me. She said she didn't think she'd been to Scotland before, and she was looking forward to seeing the landscapes and meeting the people. I mean, I just, yeah. I do find her, I know it's a cliche, but I find her incredibly irritating.
It's like a minor royal. I look forward to meeting the people and admiring the landscape. Emma Wolfe and Danny Finkelstein there. Of course, you read Danny's column every week in The Times. Just get yourself a subscription. go to thetimes.co.uk/timeswebbox. Up next, we lift the lid on the extraordinary feud between Nicola Sturgeon and Alex Salmond.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Red Box podcast. Now, it's been quite the journey for Nicola Sturgeon and Alex Salmond.
It has been the privilege of my life to serve as First Minister. But as I said often enough during this referendum campaign, this is a process which is not about me or the SNP or any political party. It's much, much more important.
That I stand here today seeking to be the second SNP incumbent of the office of First Minister is testament to how far we have come and a tribute to the extraordinary achievements and leadership of the man I aim to succeed. Alex Salmond transformed the SNP, and as First Minister, he has made Scotland a better place.
Scotland. I was released on condition that I came to the court today to face the charges against me. That I have now done. So let me say at the outset, I am innocent of any criminality whatsoever.
I was not aware of allegations or concerns about sexually inappropriate behaviour on the part of Alex Salmond.
Today, I'm announcing the public launch of a new political force, the ALBA Party. Under my leadership, seeking to build a supermajority for independence in the Scottish Parliament.
I take no pleasure whatsoever in saying this, but I think there are significant questions about the appropriateness of his return to public office, given the concerns that have been raised about his behaviour previously.
It's the Alliance, which has dominated Scottish politics for years, and it's all turned quite nasty since. After 7 years as his loyal deputy, Nicola Sturgeon took over from Alex Salmond as leader of the SNP and First Minister after the independence referendum back in 2014, when the party has continued to enjoy dominance in elections despite losing that referendum. But then it all turned in 2019 when Alex Salmond was accused of sexual assaults on 10 women, and the cracks in their relationship were laid bare. What followed was a public interrogation of how Nicola Sturgeon knew, of how much Nicola Sturgeon knew, and whether she'd covered up for her predecessor. He, of course, was cleared by the Scottish courts earlier last year. The feud reached new public heights during the 2021 Scottish elections, when Alex Salmond launched a new party, ALBA, to run against his old ally in the SNP. Well, now a new book chronicles the whole affair. It's been written by the Times' very own Scottish political editor, Kieran Andrews, and editor of The Courier, David Clegg. And they both join me now. Morning, Kieran.
Morning, Matt. How are you doing?
I'm very good. A very good night over this. And morning, David.
Good morning.
So let's start at the beginning. I feel like there's sort of a beginning, a middle, and then a who knows how it ends. Let's start with the beginning and just describe how close Nicola Sturgeon and Alex Salmond were, how they first became so close, and how they worked together for such a long time, both in and out of power in Scotland. Kieran, just paint the picture of how they formed this alliance.
So when Alex Salmond and Nicola Sturgeon took over running the SNP in 2004, which actually came about when Alex Salmond had realised Nicola Sturgeon, who was running for the leadership herself, was not going to win, and he offered to step in, run as leader, have her as his deputy. It was very similar in some ways to the Granita Pact between Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, where they kind of carved up the leadership. And at that point, the SNP was pretty much a fringe party. It didn't look like it had any chance of being in government in Scotland, never mind ending up dominating the political landscape north of the border and taking Scotland to within a couple of 100,000 votes of independence in 2014. And that relationship between Alex Salmond and Nicola Sturgeon was key to that success. It was a very close political bond. It was a very tight team around the two of them, who basically everyone had each other's backs. Everyone was working off the same page. And it was incredible unity, which was a big part of the driving force to take the SNP into power and secure their position of dominance in Scottish politics. Obviously, that has all fallen apart in the last few years.
David, was there a bit of... was part of the SNP's electoral appeal, the sort of yin and yang of Alex Salmond and Nicola Sturgeon, that he was a sort of older, gruffer man, and she was sort of a younger woman and appealed to a different part of the electorate, the sort of... particularly the sort of younger voters who came drawn into the idea of the SNP and independence. Was that part of their electoral appeal, that they both, a bit actually like Tony Blair and John Prescott, they were very different characters, but they both needed each other initially for the SNP to really build that support.
Yeah, I think there's some similarities to that Blair Prescott relationship, but actually, I think one of the key differences is the gender issue, because it had been as the book outlines, it had been a long running issue with Alex Salmond, that polling, internal research, focus groups all showed that he had a woman problem throughout his career, that he was considered aggressive and a little hectoring, and men were quite supportive of him in Scotland, but there was a gap with women. So he had been SNP leader for 10 years previously, from 1990 to 2000, and that had kind of dogged that period. When he came back in 2004, the whole thing really needed a fresh coat of paint, where it was a little bit like Back to the Future, that he was coming back to run the party again. So Nicola Sturgeon freshened that up, but also it was quite a shrewd move, because she was a young woman. She was from Glasgow, urban, where Labour had traditionally been so strong. Alex Salmond was support base was in the northeast of Scotland, much more rural farming, fishing communities, whereas Nicola Sturgeon was deeply embedded in the Scotland's biggest city. So there was lots of yin and yang there, as you said, and that was certainly part of the electoral appeal. Also, they worked very closely together. And I think the key dynamic and the key ingredient to the success really was that they were different in so many ways, you know, all the things we just described there, but also personality-wise. Alex Salmond is very gregarious. He loves socialising. He loves boozy lunches. Nicola Sturgeon, much more introspective. When she's not doing politics, she wants to be at home reading a good book. So they're very different people in almost every way, but they shared this ambition, this overriding dream of Scotland becoming an independent country. And that's what drove their politics. More than anything else, it was almost their sole goal, and that engendered a great deal of loyalty, discipline. When I covering the early days, the first term of government, the minority government between 2007 and 2011, all the political journalists here, all we talked about was how this iron discipline of the SNP, they would never brief against each other. They never fell out in public. All their disputes were kept behind closed doors. And from that era to now, it's barely recognisable because of what's happened.
It's exactly the same picture in Westminster too, that... you'd go and you'd try and sort of get to know some of the SNP MPs in Westminster, and you know, you'd have a lunch with them. They'd say, "This is all off the record." You think this could all be on the telly, and nobody would have cared. You know, it was all just towing the party line with no real insight at all. So Kieran, then so we get to 2014. We have the Scottish independence referendum. Alex Salmond resigns immediately in the wake of that, having not achieved his dream of independence. And Nicola Sturgeon is sort of the only person in the running for the job. She takes over from her former mentor. Was there a fracture in... Did they still get on at that point? Did he resent the fact that he'd had to give it up and hand it over to someone who'd previously, you know, been essentially his mentee, Kieran?
Their relationship had been drifting throughout the independence campaign. It was starting to fracture slightly there, albeit they were still on good terms generally. Alex Salmond, it was a pretty shrewd move by him to resign when he did the day after the referendum, because he then takes all of the blame away from that. There's no recriminations for the person left in post. He hands over to Nicola Sturgeon. So I don't think there was any resentment from him at resigning. But what definitely did happen was after Alex Salmond was elected as an MP and moved down to Westminster, Nicola Sturgeon's running the Scottish Government at Holyrood, what definitely happened there was a distance developed, both literally, obviously, between London and Edinburgh, where they're operating, but also personally between the two. They didn't speak as much as they might have done. Nicola Sturgeon, you know, wanted to make her own mark, so... again, didn't keep Alex Salmond in the loop as much as he might have liked. But what really, there were two instances that really fractured the relationship. And one was purely political, which was after the 2017 snap general election, when Alex Salmond lost his seat, he took up a show, or his own talk show on RP, the Kremlin-backed television station. And that that went down very badly with Nicola Sturgeon, very badly with the mainstream of the SNP. And that was the big political break. Things had been drifting for a while, but that really signified, you know, a big step towards the end of their political friendship. And then, of course, when Alex Salmond was accused of sexual misconduct, which obviously the Scottish Government investigated, that was ruled unlawful by the Court of Session. Then separately, he was cleared at the High Court of any criminality, as you said in your introduction. But that point then, when Nicola Sturgeon and Alex Salmond first discussed those allegations, that was really where the relationship ended, as she, you know, as she was effectively forced to choose between her the two things that she wants to define her as a politician, which is her Scottish nationalism and the drive for independence, and her feminism. And so she decided that these allegations should be looked at by the Scottish Government without her interference. And Alex Salmond thought that that was, you know, a departure of loyalty, which he prizes more than anything else in people.
And David, this is the sort of the substance of your book. It's called Breakup: How Alex Salmond and Nicola Sturgeon Went to War. And we've discussed this before, and Kieran's done his best many times to try and explain the sort of the ins and outs of this extraordinarily complicated series of events of who knew what when, who alleged what was investigated, how that was wrongly investigated, who said what about how it was badly investigated. If you can, just sort of sum up for us, what do you think was the key, the sort of the key events in this? In the clearly, Alex Salmond, as we mentioned, was cleared in a Scottish court of any criminal wrongdoing. But the relationship between the two of them suffered irreparably.
Yes. So I think the key events actually date back to his time in office when, as we now know, at least two civil servants had raised informal issues with their line managers about Alex Salmond's behaviour. Nothing was done about that at the time. And the book explores the culture in Alex Salmond's government at that time and how there was failures in the civil service and how they had a duty of care for their staff and a duty to deal with these types of issues when they arose. When what happens then is, and the timeline is quite key to this, is that the Me Too movement after in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein scandal that erupts towards the end of 2017, at the same time almost that Alex Salmond is taking his TV show on RT. So that relationship breaking down politically is occurring at the same time that women come forward again to the Scottish government and raise issues about Alex Salmond's alleged behaviour. Now, the Scottish government has changed its procedures in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein scandal and the Me Too movement and the whole drive for social change that was going on at that time, as we all remember, to allow retrospective investigation of ministers or first ministers. And that process begins without Nicola Sturgeon's knowledge. But the Scottish government begins to investigate the complaints from two women. Nicola Sturgeon, in both Alex Salmond and Nicola Sturgeon's account of this, learns of this from Alex Salmond in a meeting in their house in a meeting in Nicola Sturgeon's house in April 2018. He asks her to intervene. She refuses. During that meeting, he also tells her that one of these investigations had been dealt with informally at the time. He had apologised to the woman involved, and he gives Nicola Sturgeon for the first time his account of what happened. And she feels that even by his own account of what happened, which was subsequently revealed in the criminal court case, that his behaviour was not appropriate for a first minister, which is why in your package there you heard her talking about what has been revealed, suggests there's real questions about his fit for public, whether he's fit for public office now or not. So the trust is broken. In her view, the trust that she had in him is broken because of that. In his view, the trust that he had in her is broken because he puts nothing higher than loyalty, and he feels that she is being disloyal by not backing him in this situation and intervening. What we subsequently learn is that the Scottish government make an absolute cock-up of the investigation. It's It's kicked out of the court of session in the most humiliating of fashion, costs the Scottish taxpayer more than £500,000. And we have a criminal investigation going on simultaneously, which, as we know, ultimately leads to his acquittal on all charges, which leaves us now with a situation that officially those two Scottish government, the complaints to the Scottish government by the two women are still officially on the books of the Scottish government, because what the court decided was not that the complaints had no merit, but the investigation was procedurally unfair.
So that's the picture, and how they sort of they came from being great allies to how it's all fallen apart, which you detail in your book. Kevin, for the last few minutes we have, let's just reflect on what this means now going forwards. Nicola Sturgeon was committed to laying out a timetable for a second independence referendum within 100 days of the elections back in May. Where are we on that? What are the prospects of a second independence referendum? And what impact does her feud with Alex Salmond have on the prospects of her winning that?
Well, we're likely to find out more about the timetable probably next week from Nicola Sturgeon as she lays out her programme for government. And that's been delayed by a week whilst she, whilst the Scottish Greens actually join the Scottish government, which, just as a kind of segue briefly into been talking about politicians in the circus, actually Lorna Slater, one of the Scottish Greens co-leaders, who's about to become a minister, is actually a trapeze artist as well. So we have the circus coming to Holyrood quite literally in some ways. We will learn more. Nicola Sturgeon has committed to holding a second independence referendum by the end of 2023. At the moment, it's difficult to see the path for that. Powers over the constitution are reserved to Westminster. The UK government says it will not agree to a second independence referendum. So the question is, when will Nicola Sturgeon try and bring her own legislation through the Scottish Parliament? Will it make it to the floor of the Scottish Parliament? Will it pass the Scottish Parliament, which is almost certainly a yes, given there's a pretty big pro-independence majority? But then will it end up being challenged in court, and would it survive any sort of court challenge? So that seems unlikely that any Holyrood legislation for a second independence referendum would survive a court challenge, certainly according to the general assessment of most legal experts. So the path for a second independence referendum is difficult for Nicola Sturgeon. Meanwhile, she has Alex Salmond and his new Alibi Party nipping at her heels, saying the SNP is dragging its feet and not being, not being robust enough, not being hard enough in the push for a second independence referendum. Now, if it was to get to a campaign, it would be really interesting to see how, or if, probably not, the two of them could work together. But it might not be a bad thing for the Yes campaign to have a second, almost splinter group to appeal to a certain section of Scottish nationalists that that Nicola Sturgeon would probably not be wanting to speak directly to very often, as she tries to woo kind of middle Scotland and those floating soft no voters from 2014. So it's difficult to see a path to a referendum, but if it comes to it, having two distinct campaigns, a little bit like during the 2016 Brexit referendum, might not be a bad thing for the independence campaign.
I suppose, yeah, it's a bit like how you had the sort of official Vote Leave campaign in the Brexit vote, but then you had what they called Leave.eu, the sort of Nigel Farage, Aaron Banks paramilitary wing of Brexit, where they went off and did their own thing and appealed to a slightly different group of people. David, does it? I just wonder whether, because we've seen sort of support for independence sort of bob up and down. Does it make a difference? Part of the SNP's appeal, or at least they tried to make this appeal, to voters in Scotland, was they were different. They weren't like the Tories in London or the tired old Labour Party. They were different. And actually, does just the swirl of allegations and sleaze and infighting and all that sort of thing, is there a risk that they end up being just like the rest of them, if you like? They are just another bunch of politicians with all the foibles that come with that. And does that affect their ability to sell an independent Scotland as this sort of great shiny new future that they would be part of?
If
the laws of political gravity were to hold, that argument would have a lot of logic. And the SNP certainly have had their fair share of scandals in recent years. I think, however, the most interesting and marked thing about the last few years in Scottish politics, as there's a constant suggestion in the commentary and from political observers like myself, like at some point, some of this must touch Nicola Sturgeon. You know, there was the Salmond issue, the tired domestic record, other scandals which didn't get the column inches that the Alex Salmond situation did, but things that were not particularly didn't look particularly good for the SNP. And she always comes out smelling of roses. Her popularity remains very strong. You know, within 6 or 7 weeks of a committee inquiry which found against her on this issue, and that had included weeks of wall-to-wall media coverage suggesting she had acted improperly or immorally in some of her actions around this issue, and in which Alex Salmond, the politician most closely associated with her, had made all kinds of allegations about her government and the institutions of the country she was leading. After all that, she won another massive election victory, which was just short of a majority. So I think the issue there is, the opposition need to get their act together. My personal view on this is the defining issue of Scottish politics is at the minute is that nobody else looks like they would do a credible job. So the SNP will remain dominant until that changes.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. And we bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcast from?
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host Luke Jones for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.